Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm John Keimel. Today we take you to the Frontier Cafe in Brunswick for a talk by Wendell Potter. The programming was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time. This program will be archived on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand to hear the program again at your convenience or to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is Michael Gilroy, owner of the Frontier Cafe.
Thank you, Greg, and thank you all for coming out this evening. Welcome to Frontier. My name is Michael Gilroy, or Gil, as many of you know me. I've seen a lot of familiar faces here this evening, so welcome back. Greg and I were able to kind of put this together somewhat quickly. So if some of your friends ask you tomorrow or the next day why they weren't here or why they didn't know about it, you can let them know that we really did put this together quickly. So I commend you all for reading our newsletter or catching some glimpsing piece of information that we either send out directly or indirectly. So thanks for being here. One of the things we like to do on occasion is have a somewhat town hall style conversation, and we're fortunate this evening to have Mr. Wendell Potter. A few notes about Mr. Potter. Mr. Wendell Potter has served since May 2009 as the Center for Media and Democracy Senior Fellow in Healthcare. After a 20-year career as a corporate public relations executive, last year he left his job as head of communications for one of the nation's largest health insurers to try his hand at helping socially responsible organizations, including those advocating for meaningful healthcare reform, achieve their goals. Based in Philadelphia, Wendell now provides strategic communications counsel and planning services as an independent consultant. He also speaks out on both the need for a fundamental overhaul of the American healthcare system and on the dangers to American democracy and society of the decline of the media as a watchdog, which has contributed to the growing and increasingly unchecked influence of corporate PR. Before his big switch, Wendell held a variety of positions at Cigna Corporation for 15 years, serving most recently as the head of corporate communications and as the company's chief corporate spokesman. Wendell is a native of Tennessee and a graduate of the University of Tennessee in Knoxville, where he received a BA degree in communications and did postgraduate work in journalism and public relations. Mr. Wendell Potter.
Thanks very much. I appreciate that introduction and appreciate being here. I love this facility, and Gil was telling me a bit about how it came to be what it is now, and I think it's just a great venue, and I'm happy to be here and appreciate the invitation. This has been a very remarkable journey that I've been on for the past 3.5 months. I say 3.5 months because it marked that from the time that I gave my Senate testimony, kind of my coming out, if you will, in late June of this year. And along the way, I've testified before 3 congressional committees so far. I've met privately with a lot of senators and members of Congress, and I've briefed their congressional staff, and I've been the subject of a fair number of stories, and ranging from stories in my hometown newspaper in Tennessee to Time magazine. I've been on several TV programs, and a little over 3 weeks ago, my journey took me to a huge outdoor event at a county fairgrounds in Wisconsin. It was in Baraboo, Wisconsin, and the event was the 8th annual Fighting Bob Fest, which is named after Bob La Follette, the revered Wisconsin senator who, among many other things, founded Progressive Magazine 100 years ago. Thousands of people had gathered there for a day of speeches, and among the other speakers were Senators Tom Harkin of Iowa, who's now chair of the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee that Ted Kennedy chaired, and Bernie Sanders of Vermont. It was a beautiful, beautiful sunny day, not like today here, but it was a beautiful sunny day. And I asked the people to suspend disbelief for a few minutes And I asked them to imagine that it was raining like it has been raining here today. And I asked them to imagine that every one of them was either uninsured or that they had insurance with such high deductibles or limited benefits that they still couldn't afford to go to the doctor. And I asked them to imagine that they'd slept in their cars the night before, and they had to line up in the dark just before dawn to get a number that hopefully would enable them to get inside the fairground gates. And I asked them to imagine that they had been waiting in long lines in the rain, like the rain we had here today, for hours just for a chance to be treated by a doctor volunteering his or her time to help them get the medical care that they needed. And I asked them to imagine that those long lines led to barns and animal stalls that other volunteers had scrubbed down and disinfected a few days before. And then I told them that, they actually didn't have to suspend disbelief after all, because the scene that I just now described actually happens, and it happens often in this country. And I know that because I happen to experience it. I know that because I witnessed a scene just like that in the fairgrounds in Southwest Virginia, not far from where I grew up. And that was a scene that moved me so much that I knew that it was just a matter of time before I would leave my job as a spokesman for one of the largest healthcare companies in this country, and it had made it necessary for people like I saw. The industry that I work for made it necessary in many ways because of the practices for people who could have been my relatives or former neighbors to stand in line waiting for the care, to get care at animal stalls. I'd like to apologize to all of you and to other people that I've spoken to for the role that I've played over 15 years in cheating you out of the health care reform that you deserve. I'm ashamed that I let myself get caught up in deceitful and dishonest public relations campaigns that worked so well that hundreds of thousands of our fellow citizens have died, and millions more have lost their homes to foreclosures or have been forced into bankruptcy, so that a very few corporate executives could and their Wall Street masters could become very, very rich. But it was only during the last few years of my career that I came to realize the full scope of the harm that my colleagues and I had caused, and the lengths that insurance companies will go to increase their profits at the expense of working families. As I told the Senate Commerce Committee in June, the higher up the corporate ladder that I climbed, the more I could see how insurance companies confuse their customers and dump the sick, all so they can satisfy those Wall Street masters. And I described for the senators how insurance companies make promises that they really have no intention of keeping, how they flout regulations designed to protect consumers, and how they make it nearly impossible to understand or often even to obtain information that consumers need. And I told them how the industry has conducted duplicitous and well-financed public relations and lobbying campaigns every time Congress has tried to reform our healthcare system in the past, and how its current behind-the-scenes efforts may well shape reform in a way that benefits Wall Street far more than average Americans. And I noted that just as the industry did 15 years ago when it led the effort to kill the Clinton healthcare reform plan, it is once again using shills and front groups to spread lies and disinformation to scare Americans away from the very reform that would benefit them most. Make no mistake, the industry, despite its public assurances to be good faith partners with Congress and the President this time, has been at work for several years now, laying the groundwork for devious and often sinister campaigns to manipulate public opinion once again. It's easy to think of the efforts to influence opinions and actions of lawmakers as the exclusive domain of lobbyists. Much has been said and written about the millions of dollars that the special interest are spending on lobbying activities and the hundreds of lobbyists who are at work as we speak trying to shape healthcare reform legislation in Washington. Anthem, as you may have heard and read recently, reportedly has spent $9.5 million just this year alone of money that it has received from policyholders, probably some of you here in the audience, on lobbying activities. Very little attention, though, by comparison, has been written about the millions of dollars that special interests are spending on public relations activities to accomplish the same goal and that are vital to the successful lobbying efforts. One of the reasons I left my job at Cigna, where I headed corporate communications, was because I didn't want to be involved in another PR campaign that was designed to kill or gut the healthcare reform that we all need. I finally came to question the ethics of what I had done and been a part of for nearly two decades to influence decision-making and bill writing on Capitol Hill. The health insurance industry goes to great lengths to keep its involvement in these campaigns hidden from public view. But I know from having served on many trade group committees over the years that industry leaders are always full partners in developing strategies to derail any reform that might interfere with their ability to increase their company's profits. My involvement in those activities goes back to the early 1990s when insurers joined other special interests to finance the activities of an organization called the Healthcare Leadership Conference, or Council, which led a coordinated effort to scare Americans and members of Congress away from the Clinton plan. A few years after that victory, the insurance companies formed a front group called the Health Benefits Coalition to kill efforts to pass a patient's bill of rights. And while that coalition was touted as a broad-based business group, in reality, it got the lion's share of its funding from big insurance. Like most front groups, the Health Benefits Coalition was set up and run out of a big and well-connected public relations firm. One of the key strategies developed by the PR firm as the coalition was gearing up for battle in late 1998 was to stir up support among conservative talk show hosts and other media. It also formed alliances with groups like the Christian Coalition and the Family Research Council and persuaded them to send letters to Congress and to appear at press conferences. This PR firm also launched an advertising campaign in conservative media outlets. And the message was that President Clinton owed a debt to the liberal base of the Democratic Party and would try to pay back that debt by advancing the type of big government agenda on health care that he failed to get in 1994. Those tactics worked. Industry allies in Congress made sure that the patient's Bill of Rights would not become law. The insurance industry has funded several front groups like that since then, whenever the industry has been under attack. It formed the Coalition for Affordable Quality Healthcare to try to improve the image of managed care in response to a constant stream of negative stories that appeared in the media in the late 1990s. It funded another front group when lawyers began filing class action lawsuits on behalf of doctors and patients. And the PR firm that the industry hired to create that front group, by the way, had planned and conducted a similar campaign for the tobacco industry just a few years earlier. The industry also hired that same PR firm again in 2007. This is one of the last ones that I worked on, to help blunt the impact of Michael Moore's movie Sicko. It created and staffed a front group called Healthcare America specifically to discredit Moore and to demonize the healthcare systems that were featured in his movie. Among the tactics that the firm used, once again, was to enlist the support of conservative talk show hosts, writers, and editorial page editors to warn against a government takeover of the U.S. healthcare system. And I bet you all have heard that phrase lately. The term government takeover is one that the industry has used many times over the years to scare people away from reform. Healthcare America also placed ads in newspapers. One of those ads carried this message: in America, you wait in line to see a movie. In government-run healthcare systems, you wait to see a doctor. So with this history, you can rest assured that the insurance industry is up to the same dirty tricks, using the same devious PR practices it has used for many years to kill reform again this year, or even better this year, to shape reform so that it benefits insurance companies and their Wall Street investors far more than you and me and other average Americans. The creation and funding of these front groups and the use of shills on Capitol Hill and the media are not the only tactics that PR people use to support and enhance lobbying efforts. Other activities include carrying out what they call grassroots and grass tops campaigns. But a much more subtle tactic is to provide supposedly accurate and objective information to educate members of Congress and their staff members. Business Week recently described how one big health insurance company in particular has been hard at work behind the scenes providing a real treasure trove of data to key senators. And it works. A lot of senators think they're getting objective data from these companies, but I know from having worked in the industry for a long time that PR people like me and other people in these companies shape the data. They know what information to disclose, and they disclose the data selectively. So what are the long-term consequences of all this to our country and our democracy? You know, during my 20 years in corporate communications and public affairs, I participated in really in the steady growth and influence of largely invisible persuasion. And at a time when newsrooms are shrinking and investigative journalism seems to be vanishing, the number of PR people in this country long ago surpassed the number of working journalists. The ratio of PR people to reporters will continue to increase. The clear winners as this shift occurs are big, rich corporations like the ones I used to work for and other special interests. The losers, unfortunately, are average Americans, most of whom are completely unaware how their thoughts and actions are being manipulated to achieve corporate goals on Capitol Hill. I have said throughout these past 3.5 months that Americans really need to be alert to how the industry and its allies are working to influence their opinions and lawmakers' votes. I know from the many years that I spent in the industry as a PR executive how effective insurance companies have been in using these scare tactics that I've talked about to turn public opinion against any reform efforts that would threaten their profitability. I warned earlier this year that Americans and the media should pay close attention to the efforts that insurance companies and their ideological buddies would be undertaking to demonize healthcare systems around the world that don't allow for-profit companies to have the same free rein that they have here. And I said that Americans should realize that when they hear isolated stories of long waiting times to see doctors in Canada and allegations that care in other systems is rationed by government bureaucrats, that the insurance industry has written the original script. And I have said that Americans should realize that every time that we hear that we'll be heading down the slippery slope towards socialism, if Congress even enacts a public health insurance option to compete with private insurance companies, that some insurance flack like I used to be wrote that as well. Every time you hear about the shortcomings of what they call government-run health care, remember this: what we have in this country now and what the insurance industry wants to keep in place and is determined to keep in place is Wall Street-run health care. And know that we already have one of the most insidious means of rationing health care in the world, not by people that we can hold accountable on election day, but by insurance company executives who answer only to a few wealthy investors and hedge fund managers who care far more about earnings per share and something called a medical loss ratio than your health and well-being. If Congress goes along with the so-called solutions that the insurance industry says it's bringing to the table and fails to at least create a public health insurance option this time to compete with private insurance companies, as I've said before, the bill it sends to President Obama might as well be called the Insurance Industry Profit Protection and Enhancement Act. And frankly, if the bill that seems to be emerging from the Senate Finance Committee were to pass as it is now, it absolutely would be that. Some in the media seem to believe, by the way, that the insurance companies have already won, that the public option is dead, primarily because of what's going on in the Senate Finance Committee. But that is not true. It's part of their strategy to discourage advocates of reform and to think that the public option is dead, so just give up on it. And this is because, you know, it's part of the billions of dollars that they're spending and had been spending over several years to get ready for this debate, to influence the votes on Capitol Hill. It's not too late to keep the insurance companies from winning again, but time is running short. The next few weeks are going to be very important They really are getting down to the wire in Congress of deciding what to do and what form health care reform will take this year. So we need to think of the coming weeks as some of the most important weeks in the history of this country. We've got 46 million people who are uninsured. We've got 25 million more who are underinsured. So this is vitally important for them and vitally important for all of us, because we all are just a layoff away from being among the uninsured. And we're just a health policy change away from being in the underinsured. If we want to take back control of our healthcare system from the big for-profit companies that have wrecked it, we've got to take back control of this debate. And we've got to begin to talk in ways that reach our neighbors and our friends who've been influenced by all these lies and this disinformation that I've talked about and that I've been a part of in the past. We need to tell them that we can continue to have a system that allows 45,000 of us to die every year, one every 12 minutes, one American every 12 minutes, because they don't have health insurance. Or we can have a system that will make sure that their sons and their daughters are not one of them. We should ask the skeptics of a public option who are afraid of giving people a choice of a government-run plan, who are afraid that it will lead to socialism, that if they would want to go back to the days when Americans had to buy private fire insurance. We need to remind our family members and our friends and neighbors why we're having this debate in the first place. If they tell you they don't want their tax dollars to be used for someone else's health care coverage, point out to them that they already are paying for the care that uninsured people receive every time they go to the emergency room. And those of us actually who are insured are paying an extra $1,000 in premiums on average every year to pay for that uncompensated care. If they say that they don't want to saddle their children and their grandchildren with additional taxes, ask them if they've thought about what might happen to their children and grandchildren if they found themselves among the millions of people without health insurance, or more likely in the coming years, and most definitely if the Baucus bill were to pass, among the underinsured. And ask them how they would feel if their daughter came down with breast cancer soon after she and your son-in-law moved into the dream house, and just as your grandchildren were beginning to think about college. Ask them how they would feel if their daughter and son-in-law learned that the insurance that they thought would be there when they needed it required them to pay so much out of their own pockets that they couldn't afford to pay for their daughter's cancer treatments and keep their house. Ask them how they would feel if their children and grandchildren were forced out of their dream homes and into bankruptcy. And ask them how they would feel if their grandchildren had to give up their dreams of going to college. And ask them how they would feel when they found out that their daughter was forced to pay more for her care out of her own pocket than she could afford, just so that some insurance company executive, some CEO, could make $20 million a year, and so that his company or her company would meet Wall Street's expectations. Folks, I believe we Americans, by and large, are compassionate. I believe that we all believe in individual responsibility, but I believe we also care about each other. I don't know a single American who would knowingly wish the future I just described in anyone's family. But once again, you don't have to suspend disbelief. That happens every day in this country. I was talking to a woman just earlier at the courthouse who was telling me that she lost her brother because of an insurance company saying that he had pre-existing condition, so they were not going to pay for his care, and he died. She herself lost her coverage as she was battling cancer herself. She lost her home. These are people that you know, who are your neighbors. This happens every single day. So over the coming weeks, we must tell our friends and others who are worried needlessly about a government takeover of our healthcare system that what we all really need to be concerned about is the Wall Street takeover that really has occurred while we weren't paying attention and while the news media was not paying attention. It is that takeover that has led to more and more working Americans being forced into the ranks of the uninsured. And it is that takeover that has forced millions more of us into the ranks of the underinsured, because insurance companies are making us pay so much more, so many thousands of dollars more out of our own pockets before they'll pay a dime. It is that takeover that has forced many of our neighbors out of their homes and into bankruptcy. And it is that takeover that is causing more and more small businesses to stop offering coverage to their employers, to their employees, because of the exorbitant premiums that greedy Wall Street-driven insurance companies are charging them. I want to close by suggesting that all of us who know the importance of healthcare reform and who are advocates of healthcare reform, that we pledge to each other that we'll be working doubly hard over the coming weeks, because these weeks are very important if we're going to have the ability to ensure that America finally joins the rest of the developed world in making sure that all of its citizens, our brothers and our sisters, our sons and our daughters, our neighbors and our co-workers, have good coverage that we all will have the peace of mind knowing will be there when and if we need it. And it's really when we need it, because we all will need it at some point in our lives. The public option is not dead. It's vitally important to keep the insurance industry honest. Senator Snow has said that she is concerned that a public option would have an unfair advantage. What is fair about the way the insurance companies have been operating? What is fair about that, Senator Snow? So folks, it's important over the coming weeks to let her know, to let every member of Congress that you know of, that a public option is vitally important. It's the least that she can do for you. Thank you. Yes, any questions? Be glad to try to answer any questions. I don't have answers to everything. If I don't, I'll say it up. But, yes, sir.
I'm in favor of a single-payer, universal approach. What I'm concerned about the public option, which I'm for, by the way, is that all the high-risk individuals will end up in that pool, and it will go broke. And the private health insurance companies will then say, look, the government program doesn't work. That's what I'm afraid of. I don't know what the law says about that, what the provisions are to avoid that type of scenario.
Well, the final law hasn't been written, but it would have to include language that would create risk adjustment that would help prevent that from happening. But you're right, there'd be that danger. Both the private insurers and the public option would want to have certainly young, healthy individuals as well, and the public option should attract those individuals as well. There will need to be some laws that address cherry picking. The insurance industry has said that they are willing to give up the ability to do the cherry picking, but it would have to be absolutely a part of the laws, the regulations that are put in place, and those regulations would have to be enforced very carefully. You're right, it's a concern, but it's something that regulations can be put into place to keep from happening. Yes, sir.
You said that the public option is not dead. In what way is it alive?
It's alive because it's a part of three of the House committees that have finished their work. It was a very strong part of the bill that was reported out of the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee. So four of the five committees that have reported or reporting out bills, the Finance Committee is finishing its work, but four out of five of those committees have reported out bills that contain provisions creating a good public option. So, and the House is very committed to it. I've talked to many members of both the House and the Senate. I know that there's strong support for it. The insurance industry and its shills want you to think that it's dead. It's one of their tactics, but it definitely is a lie. But the insurance industry knows that it can kill it. One way to kill it is to create the perception that it's already dead. And that's why it's important not to give up on it. There's no reason. If you give up, you're giving in to the health insurance industry's tactics. It can be a part of legislation. I think the House will have to exert a lot of leadership here because all of the House bills include it. Speaker Pelosi is a strong advocate of it. She says the House won't pass a bill that doesn't include it, and she needs to stick to her guns. Yes.
You mentioned that one of the ways of helping national health or single payer or a program would be to take control of the discussions in a sense. I have two things that I would like to say right now. One is that I think that the whole issue of patriotism has been subsumed by this sort of hysterical slippery slope of socialism discourse. I consider myself to be a patriot, and I have this idea that we'll never know how great our country can be until we have national health, until we have this real America.
Yeah.
Now, a second thing that I think of a lot, and I really hope that you will educate me as to, I think that I dropped my health insurance because I'm a healthcare provider and I find it morally inconsistent with my work to have insurance that my patients don't have. Mm. I don't require that everybody agree with me, but I do really like the idea of people who do agree that it's a moral issue to stop paying their health insurance premiums. And I'm wondering that if enough people, you know, in a sense, went on a strike against paying the premiums, you know, would that possibly put a good pressure on the conversations about real health reform?
You know, I think you raise two good points. The first on patriotism, and I think one of the things that I wish that advocates of reform, including the president and members of Congress, had done is talk about this in terms of the economic consequences of not reforming this our healthcare system. With so many people uninsured and underinsured, they're not getting the healthcare that they need. As you well know, our society is not as healthy as it should be. We also have this antiquated system that, for better or worse, most of us get our health care through the workplace. I'm not saying that should go away, but many of us feel locked in our jobs. We're afraid to go to start our own business or to go to a startup because we might not have the ability to get health insurance, especially if we've got a pre-existing condition. So there's this thing called job lock. We're losing a lot of contributions to our economy because would-be entrepreneurs are staying in jobs that they feel stuck in because of they're afraid they won't be able to get benefits or to afford benefits if they leave. So I think and small businesses are at a disadvantage too. They can't offer health insurance to their employees if they try at affordable rates. And that is as good as large employers. So it is an economic issue. You've probably heard that General Motors has been in such a dire straits, partly because it has to pay more for health insurance for its employees and retirees than it pays for steel. It's gotten to be that way in this country. To your second point of going on strike, I'm concerned that we ultimately get to the point that will be a logical thing for people to do, even with some reform that might pass, particularly if it does not include a public option. I'll tell you why. The business model that the insurance companies have is absolutely not sustainable. The way they are essentially controlling costs now is to shift more of the financial cost of healthcare away from them and employers and to employees. The average household income in this country is $50,000. That means that half of the households in this country make less than that. With premiums continuing to increase and with people being required to pay more out of their own pockets for care, more and more of us are not going to be able to go to our doctors and pick up our medicines. it's not sustainable. One of the problems I have in particular with the Baucus bill and the fact that it doesn't include a public option is because we would all be forced to buy insurance. We wouldn't have a public option as an alternative. So it would be an enormous revenue stream for the insurance companies that already last year, just seven of the largest insurance companies had total revenues of $250 billion. They want to have a lot more money from those who are currently uninsured and to get about $500 billion in government subsidies from taxes that you and I pay that would go to them as subsidies to help people who can't afford insurance to buy it. So they see this as an absolute bonanza. It would be a jackpot for them. It would be a bailout for the health insurance industry to enable them to continue to operate a system that is otherwise unsustainable. But even with reform, even with that, at some point we're going to reach the point where people cannot pay out of their own pockets what the insurance companies is going to make them pay. Yes. Yeah, it's part of their messaging to call you young, invincible. They do categorize you as that. They want you to be insured. They say that most young people who are uninsured are that way by choice because they feel that they're bulletproof, that they're young and invincible. I know a lot of young people who would love to be able to have insurance, but they simply can't afford with jobs when they're starting out in their careers to be able to afford decent coverage. A lot of these companies now, including WellPoint, the parent company of Anthem, in Ohio, just recently got permission from the state of Ohio, where they'll apparently prove anything, to offer to sell these kinds of high deductible plans that feature, and these are geared toward you and your fellow young people, a deductible of $20,000. So you would be paying your premiums to Anthem, to WellPoint. You're young, you're probably not going to need to use your insurance to any great extent unless you get seriously ill or injured, and that will happen to some people. But if you do, your insurance company won't pay anything until you've already spent $20,000. That's what they have in store for us, folks. The barriers to entry are enormous. What you have right now is truly, I call it a cartel of very large insurance companies. WellPoint, Anthem being one of the, in fact, the biggest in terms of membership. United, Aetna, Cigna, Humana, HealthNet, and Coventry are the seven big companies that form this cartel. They are the largest publicly traded companies that the Wall Street analysts follow. One out of every three Americans that has insurance in this country has a benefit plan from one of those seven companies. They talk a lot about the fact that we have quite a bit of competition now. That's nonsense. One out of every three people who are privately insured are insured by just one of these seven companies. And that is the result of enormous consolidation that has taken place in the industry over the last few years. WellPoint didn't exist like it does now just many years ago. It exists now because of the Blue Cross plans converting from nonprofit to for-profit status and WellPoint coming in and buying a bunch of them up. So you've got this huge company operating for-profit Blue Cross Blue Shield plans around the country. United did the same thing. It grew by mergers and consolidation. Cigna is a product of mergers and acquisitions. Aetna is. They all are. They've taken smaller players out where they've merged with each other, and that's why you have so little competition. This has created barriers to enter certain markets to be so high that small players can't, even some of the big players can't crack into certain markets. Cigna is based in Philadelphia, where I live, has always been based there since it's been, since Cigna has existed as a company. It cannot crack into the Philadelphia market in any big way because it is controlled by Independence Blue Cross of Philadelphia, of Pennsylvania, and Aetna, which bought bought its way into the market several years ago when it bought U.S. Healthcare. So those two companies are the dominant players. Cigna would love to be a bigger player in its hometown. It just simply cannot do it. It's not big enough, and size matters in this industry. That's why the co-op idea is absolutely ludicrous. Anyone who knows anything about the insurance industry knows that a co-op, a startup co-op, would not have a snowball's chance of ramping up to be big enough to compete in any market. It just will not work. So there's no private competitor. If that were to be a possibility, they would have done it a long time ago. You would have a lot of private companies competing for your business in Maine, but you don't. You know what the situation is like in Maine. When some player becomes dominant in a market, they can keep the other players out. A public option could be different if it can mass up to be significant in size on a national basis. It still would have some issues in negotiating contracts at the local level, but it would be able to bulk up in certain with members to be able to compete better than certainly better than co-ops and better than some of the smaller private competitors. Yes. You know, it's the industry talking point. One of the talking points is that if a public option is created, that it will lead us to a single payer system. I don't think it will. I think even some. Well, the legislation, if in the House, it conceivably could. And I'm not saying it won't. Nobody knows what would happen. No one knows how strong it would be out of the box and how much it could grow in future years. That's an unknown. It conceivably could. The health insurance companies certainly could figure out how to do business and make money, even if we had a single payer system like they do in some other countries. Cigna has operations abroad. They sell supplemental insurance in England and other places, for example. But the point I was going to make is that the House version of some of the bills, there have been amendments that would allow states to create single payer systems, and some states the number of states, there's been legislation that's been introduced, even here in Maine. In Pennsylvania, there's a fairly serious effort toward that. California lawmakers have passed legislation that would enact a single payer system twice, but Governor Schwarzenegger has vetoed it twice. So it's conceivable that it could start at the state level, which is how it started in Canada. The Canadian single payer system began at the provincial level, not the federal level. But it obviously now is federal policy. You know, you raise a scary specter, but if there were to be many people coming down with something very serious, even a pandemic, and having to pay a lot of their own pockets, it could be financially ruinous for a lot of families. Yes. Of course. That's right, yeah. You know, it's interesting. One of the big advocates of so-called consumer-directed healthcare is a Harvard professor named Regina Herzlinger. And I've heard her speak. My former company paid her $30,000 to speak to a group of analysts not too long ago. She often talks up the Swiss system as a model. And it does have something like a consumer-driven system with private insurance companies competing, and they've achieved close to universal coverage there. What she doesn't tell audiences, certainly not that audience, was that they don't allow for-profit insurance companies to operate, and it is very heavily regulated. There's rate controls that keep costs down. But even with that, the U.S. spends more per capita on healthcare than any other country in the world except, guess who? Switzerland. But on the state level, that's been an idea that's been proposed by Senator Carper of Delaware as kind of an alternative, or let's see if we can't get a full-fledged public option nationally. Let's see if it'll work at the state level before starting at the national level.
Especially in Delaware.
Which is right. That's right. It's just another thing like the co-ops that. He's a Democrat, and so is Senator Conrad of North Dakota, who's advocating the co-ops. They're throwing this out there, knowing that they sound good. Maybe some people will buy it as a reasonable alternative, and it may wind up in legislation, and lawmakers might stamp it reform and say we're done for now, but it won't be. But just relegating it to something that would start at the state level would be almost like saying, well, let's see if co-ops can work. It just wouldn't do. It won't do the trick. Yeah.
I'm having trouble wrapping my head around the requirement I know that exists in Massachusetts, and that seems possibly kind of a way that we have to buy insurance.
Yeah.
And I wonder how any kind of reasonable congressperson without some ulterior motive can see that as realistic.
Yeah, you know, I agree with you. In fact, during his campaign, candidate Obama he opposed an individual mandate because he said, why would you force someone to buy something they can't afford? Now he's supporting it. He's been persuaded to that position by insurance company executives. I know he has. That enjoys quite a following in Congress, too, obviously. Yesterday, Senator Snow was quoted in the New York Times as saying that she had misgivings about an individual mandate for the very same reasons that Obama mentioned in the campaign. Why would you force someone to buy something they can't afford? And the only alternative is to provide these enormous subsidies from the taxpayers. Everyone needs to be covered. And that's a worthy goal, obviously, and a mandate would be one way to try to achieve that. But it would require all of us, without a public option, certainly, to buy it from private, mostly for-profit insurance companies. That doesn't make sense to me. That's not the way that I would I'd run along.
It's extortion, really.
It is. I mean, it is almost saying you will buy our product or you will pay a big penalty. You will buy a product from a big for-profit company, or you will be penalized greatly. It is a form of extortion, if you ask me, and it is an enormous bailout of the health insurance industry. No doubt about it. Yes?
Forgive me for asking that. It's the great promise of capitalism that if you don't like the product that's offered to you, you don't have to buy it. Yet with the health insurance industry, that's not there. People don't have the option, realistically, of not buying it. So the question is, do we even have capitalism at work here?
You, in a sense, you don't. You have a plutocracy at work here. And some people have said, we need to. If you have to buy auto insurance, well, why don't you make people buy health insurance? Well, you don't have to buy a car.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't by choice or by necessity. You don't have to do that, but health is different. We all at one time or another probably going to need to have some health care. Yes.
What about this, the character of this national endowment of health care, do you think, what does that say about the role of corporate money in politics? And what do you think needs to change, perhaps, about the system of campaign finance regulation?
Yeah, it is something that needs to be addressed. I spoke couple of weeks ago on a panel in Washington with some people who've done a lot of work on campaign finance reform. It's the reform that we've seen so far is very inadequate. It still enables private corporations to run Washington with their corporate contributions and the way they can hire and deploy lobbyists all over Capitol Hill. I'm not sure. Lobbyists, there are regulations on lobbying, but if one company can spend almost $10 million so far in 1 year on lobbying, those of us just regular Joes don't have anything like that kind of representation. It's another reason why we are moving into dangerous territory away from democracy and even republic in terms of our government into sadly, a corporate-run plutocracy in many ways. We do need to have a lot of reform of campaign finance law and probably laws that look at and address lobbying. One thing that probably can't be addressed, although I think it should in some way, are the invisible persuaders that I've been talking about some, the use of the PR firms to hide where your money's going, and setting up for front groups. I think that should be looked at if the intent clearly is to ultimately influence legislation as these groups ultimately do. That should also be under scrutiny. Yes?
Do you think the media is doing its job?
No. No, absolutely not. They have failed us miserably in years past. And I say this having been a reporter for many years. My first career was a reporter, and I covered Capitol Hill for a while in Washington and the White House. A lot of things are going on. You've got the mainstream media shrinking, newspapers disappearing, newsrooms shrinking, people not getting their news like they used to from the Walter Cronkite's of the world and going to getting it from Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck and Keith Olbermann and Ed Schultz. I mean, we select where we get our information now because we have that ability to do that. And with the decline of the mainstream media, there are fewer places to get objective information. And even those places are not doing an adequate job. They this thing that has always existed called bandwagon journalism. You cover the same story that your competitor covered, and you cover it the same way. And most of the coverage that you see in Washington is about the horse race, or who's currently winning in the Senate, who's exerting the most influence, rather than why we're having this debate in the first place. You see a few exceptions. Occasionally a good story in the Wall Street and in the New York Times or even the Wall Street Journal or the LA Times, but most people don't see some of the best reporting because of the way the media is structured, and there's not nearly enough of it. Yes?
There's been some discussion in this debate of those of us that have employer-provided health care plans being taxed in some capacity. Could you discuss what the various proposals are in the committee bills and how that would work, and is that still something that's being debated actively in Washington?
It is still being debated. It's something that could wind up in legislation as a way to pay for health care reform to a certain extent. What he's talking about is this proposal that Republicans at least call it taxing Cadillac plans, the so-called Cadillac plans, which no one has really, that I've seen, have really defined, but they presumably are benefit plans that have inordinately rich benefits or that the people who enroll in these plans don't pay very much out of their own pocket for this kind of insurance. And one of the proposals is to tax those plans if they are reaching a certain level of cost. I think it's a bad idea because I think all the plans are moving in the direction of being pretty expensive. But what it would do at the end of the day is insurance companies wouldn't offer many of those plans that have good benefits. You'd see it would have the effect, in my opinion, of accelerating the trend toward these high deductible plans and the limited benefit plans. That would be, in my view, the intended or unintended consequence of taxing those kinds of plans. In the House, the bill that H.R. 32, which is the one that's most often cited, probably the one that will be the bill that reaches the House floor and will be amended, wouldn't do that. It would tax high-income people, and there's been a big backlash against that too. And you know, from a lot of people who make $50,000 a year and have probably no chance of ever making $300,000 or even $250,000 a year. But when you raise just the word tax, a lot of people get all freaked out. Even if you're talking about taxing the income of just maybe 1 or 2% percent of the highest earners in the country.
Just as a follow-up, are the proposals to levy a premium against the employers who are providing the insurance or to the consumers of those health care plans? And
it would affect the tax deductibility, as I understand it, probably would affect both the employer and the employee, I guess. I don't know how it would ultimately be configured or worded, but conceivably could be a tax on both, which, of course, would be a disincentive for employers to offer those kinds of plans and a disincentive for those who enroll in them to stay in them. Yes. I think more of us are coming to the consensus, but there are plenty of folks who don't think that healthcare is a right. They don't think that they have an obligation to help anybody else, and that this is a country where people have the ability to advance, to earn a good standard of living, and if you don't make it, too bad, so sad. There are plenty of people who still believe that, unfortunately. I was on a radio program a couple months ago in Florida, and there was a guy who was a small business owner and chairman of the Republican Party in Hillsborough County, Florida, and he was espousing the point of view that, look, I made it, I am a self-made man, I earned every penny I'm making, why do I have an obligation to help somebody else? You find, unfortunately, people like that or like-minded, but I think that people I see, most people don't view the world that way, but there are a lot of people who do. Yes. Okay, this is it.
I'm interested in sort of the history of sort of reforms that are of the scale of the one that we're going through right now. I think I read an interesting article the other day about in the New York Times, or the column, I can't remember by who, but talking about when Social Security was first created, that it was a bill that probably nobody in this room would have ever voted for. Some somewhat racist exemptions. Many industries were fully exempted from being a part of it.
It's a very good question, and a lot of the devil will be the details after this bill passed. The Senate finance or block this bill would leave a lot of the rulemaking or regulatory decision-making, give it to this organization called the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, or NAIC, which is made up of state insurance commissioners, but it's a private organization. So the Baucus bill would give remarkable authority to this one organization, and that concept has been criticized in particular because it's often seen as a stepping stone to go from the insurance from a government job to a big corporate job, which often happens with these insurance commissioners or people who are within the NAIC. Regulation is going to be vitally important. Who determines the regulations? Whether there'll be an additional federal regulation that will, and whether it will preempt state regulations. And yes, the insurance industry will have a lot to say about that and try to influence it and make sure that the regulation is as weak as possible, you know, and try to make sure that the standard benefit plan that emerges from this bill will be as limited as possible. So they'll be at work, but a lot of work will be done after the bill is passed when it reaches the rule setting and who is actually going to be putting into place, how is it going to be implemented, who's going to be determining the rules. And you can bet your dollar that the insurance companies will be right there trying to influence it every step of the way. So there will need to be a big watchdog role. People and the media's attention will go on to something else. That's when this will all, you know, pretty much vanish from the media's radar screen, and a lot of that will be done out of public view. We won't have the kind of debate we're having right now in the congressional debate, and that'll be a vitally important period of time.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming out.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. Today's speaker was Wendell Potter. He spoke at the Frontier Cafe in Brunswick earlier this month. If you'd like to purchase a taped copy of today's Speaking in Maine, please call MPBN's Audience Services Department at 1-800-884-1717. Again, for a copy of today's Speaking in Maine with Wendell Potter, the number to call is 1-800-884-1717. You can also listen to the program again at any time by accessing it on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand or Podcasts to access the program and many other Archive Speaking in Maine programs. For Speaking in Maine, I'm John Keimel.